recorded in Los Gatos, California on December 29, 2015. This is GeekSpeak. You're listening to independent public radio 88.9 KOSP Santa Cruz and streaming live worldwide at kosp.org. Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KOSP or any of the Geek's affiliated organizations. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the studio is Brian Young. He's a CG artist, iOS developer, and a lifelong tinkerer. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Lyle. Have a good Christmas?
I did have a good holiday break.
Did you have a good Star Wars break?
I did. I would love to talk about Star Wars. I don't think we are, because some people might have be tuning in and not have seen it. The one thing I want to talk about it and to everybody is that you should go see it, because I enjoyed the movie. We also have Miles Elam, software engineer and political junkie. Hey, Miles.
Hey, how you doing?
Did you see the movie?
I did.
And you recommend it to people?
I thought it was better than any of the prequels, and I thought it wasn't as good as Empire.
Cool. Well, let's talk about, since we're not going to talk about Star Wars, let's go ahead and talk about space in general.
We've made a small baby step with regard to making space travel cheaper, at least the regular trips we have to make to orbit to send supplies up, by having SpaceX landing their – I mean – nailing their landing.
They finally did it.
Falcon 9, the first stage, after it detaches from the second stage, and so the rest of Falcon 9 goes up into orbit, the first stage will normally, in a rocket, just fall back to Earth, you know, land in the ocean, you know, maybe they'll try to recover it and try to recover some parts, but generally pretty difficult. Grasshopper, their name for their first stage, on the other hand, actually landed.
So it
went back to its pad and landed.
And that's just the first stage. It just helps get the initial second stage up higher and then lands. How can they do that with – I mean they need to have a certain amount of fuel to be able to land it as well.
Yes.
Yeah, normally – I mean traditionally those giant rockets are dropped into the ocean and they just get destroyed. Sometimes they're kind of recoverable but not reusable.
Well, the space shuttle tank was.
Reusable?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, the big orange portion, that was...
Reusable, but it wasn't landed. That it splashed down, basically, right? In parachutes.
Actually, were the solid rocket boosters reusable? I can't remember.
I don't think they were.
I think they were.
I mean, they were... I'm sure they used materials. They kept them and all that. It wasn't like they were just dropped in the ocean and left. They were definitely recovered. But I don't think they reused them for spaceflight.
Right.
But in any case, the Falcon 9 rocket, and they tried this many times, there's a great shot of it almost landing on a barge and it falling over at the last minute. So this one actually did – it really reminds me – what was that video game, the vector video game where you landed a ship vertically?
Lunar Lander.
Mm-hmm. It totally felt like that, right?
Oh, yeah.
You had to deal with gravity effects and it slowly floated down. At the last minute, you had to hit your rocket just a little bit to cushion the last landing part. And, of course, you always hit the rocks and failed miserably.
Right. But in answer to your question – I forgot your question.
About how it needs to use fuel to land itself.
Yes.
Down.
This runs under the heading of rocket science is hard.
Well, I mean, the expensive thing about rocket flight is weight, and yet you're carrying extra weight so that you can return this thing back to its pad.
Right. But as opposed to the weight of fuel to get it accelerated to a point where you can send that second stage up off into orbit, all you have to do is slow your descent enough just as you are getting to the ground and keep your orientation correct that you can make it cushioned enough that it can land successfully. So it's not like trying to accelerate to Mach 6. It's like you hit terminal velocity and you're coming down. You try to orient yourself so you're upright and then you hit that brake.
So terminal velocity, of course, is when you go through air very quickly, you'll feel wind. And if you stick your hand out of a car window, you'll push your hand. Your wind pushes against your hand so much that it feels like a force. At a speed in our atmosphere that's fast enough, you no longer accelerate down to Earth because that cushion of air is pushing you back at the equal amount that you could increase. And therefore, that's called the terminal velocity. You don't actually increase your velocity because the air friction holds you back.
So is that the same reason why a feather goes so slowly to the ground?
Yes. A feather's terminal velocity is much slower than a bowling ball's terminal velocity.
Right.
Exactly.
Confusing school children for eons.
That's right. It has nothing to do with actual gravity. Gravity is a constant, 9.8 meters per second per second. So this Falcon 9 is 991 iterations away from Star Wars, right?
Other than the fact that the Star Wars universe very much seems like it has the subluminous ether as a medium as opposed to the vacuum of space.
Okay, wait a second.
Like all the physics of Star Wars really lead toward that.
If we're going back to Star Wars is not sci-fi. Star Wars is great, but it's not science fiction.
How so?
It's total fantasy. Look at all the technology in it.
Speculative fiction encompasses sci-fi and fantasy. Yes, it's the same genre, if you will. Yeah.
We're not going to reach Star Trek or Star Wars.
Star Wars?
No.
Yes, going across the galaxy, but there's no time dilation.
Right. There's problems with that.
So do you have any idea how much fuel that they have to save? Is it just a tiny fraction then?
I don't. Is it a tiny fraction of the whole?
Yes. Yeah, but it's not like 10%.
It's a series of controlled burns to get it back to where it's supposed to be.
Miles, I fully believe that SpaceX landing their craft again makes a lot of sense to them, because if it didn't financially make sense, they wouldn't do it. This is a corporation with goals of being successful, and mm-hmm. to do that, you have to pinch your pennies. So absolutely makes sense that they have some reason for doing this, but I can't fathom why it's so important to land this thing. What savings do you actually get by saying this thing is completely reusable over and over again? What actually
There's the question, and that's the question a lot of people have with regard to how much cost savings they'll get from it. Is it going to be that they can just refuel it and get going? That probably isn't the case. Will they just do cursory inspections, or will they take the whole thing apart and inspect it and put it back together again, in which case that's going to be fairly expensive, but they don't have to remake parts if they aren't broken. But that's not necessarily the most expensive part.
That's a good point, that the learning about it as they do it is probably the best goal, right? I mean, the money savings of not having to refabricate it maybe is balanced to some degree by having to check it again. Right. At the same time, we don't make airplanes every time we fly. Right. We reuse them. And the whole industry of reuse means that it's a lot cheaper than it would be if we used them one time. So from that perspective, if you compare it to an airplane, I just don't compare those rockets to an airplane. But maybe that's just because I was raised with rockets being disposable in some ways. Yeah. And in a new era where we do it a lot more, we just can't function that way. It makes sense.
Now, bear in mind that the first stage does not go up all the way into
right.
low orbit.
It doesn't make orbit, right?
And so when it's coming down, you don't have the same stresses that you would have for a reentry vehicle.
Oh, that's good.
You're not going into orbit and then having to do an air brake on the atmosphere and have heat shields on it. You're going up and then the first stage is coming back down again.
So this really is more comparable to an airplane as far as the stresses and the...
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
So SpaceX, to really be
clear, compared to a reentry vehicle, yeah. But.
You started the segment talking about how we're being successful in space flight again. We have a new space era, if I'll take it to that idea. But this is corporate flight, right? This is not the same as NASA doing it. This is a independent commercialization of space.
But as it stands right now, SpaceX seems to be doing things fairly cheaply compared to government contractors. So we'll see how it goes. They are not blazing new territory. This is still the purview of NASA to go to Europa and get samples and to drop rovers on Mars and stuff like that. NASA still has that position of they are blazing the new trails that no one has done before. What's happening now is you have the corporate market stepping in to do those things where the trail has already been blazed, where the trail has already been made, where they see the end result already and are just trying to make it more efficient.
Cool.
Which is a laudable goal. It's wonderful.
Absolutely. Hey, Brian, will you tell us more about laudable goals?
Laudable goals. So something pretty cool happened in my little geek circles. They have open sourced the Swift language that Apple has in just the last 18 months announced and then improved upon. And it's now out in the public's hands.
Apple, traditionally software development, Apple is done with Objective-C, which showed up in the next era of computing prior to Jobs going back to Apple. It was actually an earlier language than that, but Objective-C has its C roots, and we won't get into a lot of detail. But a couple years ago at their WWC forum, they said, we have a new language, and it really surprised everybody that they were producing a new language. And it's contemporary language, has really some really cool features in it.
Well, yeah, it just allows Apple developers to start using a language that has a lot of the modern features that have been made in, like, Google has their Go language. There's many other languages that are relatively recent that have really improved, make the language easier to read, more expressive, more composable, and all these things are in Swift. So it's great. But what I thought was so cool, and you've got to go actually see the video to appreciate this, but somebody has used an open source tool to visualize the commit history that was released with Swift being open source.
Okay, so, before we go into that visualization,
yeah,
let's talk about what, first off, open source, when they announced last year that they were open sourcing Swift, all of us were like, oh, cool. Are they really going to? Because they've said that a lot, that they'd open source a project.
So Darwin is their core of their operating system.
Right.
It's the Unix core, and they open source that. But that kind of open sourcing that they did was after 4, 5, 6 months after releasing the latest operating system, they'll release that open source part as one big dump of files, which that's not really the spirit of open source.
Right.
The spirit of open source is that people get to contribute to it, read through it in real development time.
Not just as the source code open to everybody, but the actual whole process is open so that you can participate at multiple levels. So external people from Apple could potentially do that. And that's what they've done with this new with Swift open source. They took their entire history of developing the language internally to Apple that was all private, and they put it all publicly available on GitHub, which is a kind of de facto place to share code currently. And you can see the entire history of everything they've done to the language from the beginning.
Right.
Which is kind of amazing.
There's some question about whether some of it was cleaned up or altered in the beginning, or whether we're getting the actual raw history. But it definitely appears to be 5 years of the history from the very first commit of the basic shell of the idea.
So when we talk about commit, if you've ever had like a Word document and you wanted somebody else's input and you emailed it to them and they worked on the document and then emailed it back to you, and during that time you might have modified your document, you have this problem at this point because you've modified your local Word document, your letter to somebody, and somebody else has modified it and sent it back to you, and you don't know where the changes are. You kind of have to like compare it back and forth, and it's time consuming and laborious. And in the software development world, that's basically what we're all doing. We're all writing stuff. We're writers, and we're writing in these programming languages. And we're writing the same stuff at the same time, like giant novels. We're each writing little pieces of it. And so as you work on it, you have to be aware that Miles made a change to some character's name, and then Brian came along and actually fixed something that I had written. And in that time, we all need to be able to sync up to each other. And so the way we do that is source management software. And the one that's very popular now is called Git, G-I-T. It was actually invented by the same guy that invented Linux, Linus Torvalds. Real jerk of a guy, but amazing developer. Anyway, and Git has commits. All the changes you make are called a commit. And if I make a change, that's wrapped up in this thing called a commit, which has a very unique number. And then when I send my packets of commits to Miles and Brian, they can pull them into their repository very cleanly, and we can all reference them uniquely. And anything else about Git and source
control? Well, source control isn't a new thing.
No, of course.
Git didn't add that. What Git added was being ridiculously fast compared to everything that preceded it.
And non-centralized. There's no owner. There's no repo.
That had been done before as well.
Sure.
Just not as fast. Right?
Okay, so yeah.
Okay, so there we go.
This history, this whole history of how it changed and evolved, who added to it, when they added to it, and the graph of how things are related within all the different files, all that is the commit history. And what surprised people in the Apple developer circles is that they released that entire 5 years of history. And when they did that, somebody took this open source tool to visualize what that looks like, to show a movie over time, a couple minute long movie of each thing being added. And what you see is this incredible spider web of names. And what happens when a new feature is added, you'll see a giant blob of new parts of this visual graph, this visual web stuck together. And you can see the original author is Chris Lattner. It was it's basically his baby. And you can see him jumping around and touching different parts of it at different times. And you can see as they're getting ready to release this to the world, how quickly changes happen. And the first reactions from the developer world and what they think of how this language works and the syntax and the features in it, all of a sudden there's explosions of activity related to this. Or there's explosions to activity related to, well, we didn't really like the name of that function. That kind of confused people. Let's make it make sense this way. And all of a sudden, the entire thing just explodes again in activity. So it's just a fascinating movie for anybody who's interested in software development or even in just how a relationship graph can be visualized.
The thing that's so neat about this era is that we have lots of people developing lots of creative time, creating something, and a complete record of how it works. That's neat. We don't normally get that. You know, even if you have a collaboration like making a movie, you have the movie, you have the credits at the end. But, you know, there's a whole bunch of director's assistants and you're not really sure what they did, right? I mean, the idea that you can actually like really kind of navel gaze at the source code and see exactly who participated and how and what decisions were made is pretty cool.
Yeah, no, it's pretty cool. And in particular, you can see things like, oh, Chris Lattner tends to work on bugs at 11 o'clock at night on a weekend.
I think about that a lot when I'm doing development, if I'm late at night. One of the things I set up years ago when I first started at Netflix, because I do Git at Netflix, I set up a hook, a thing that actually runs every time I make a commit, and that takes a photograph of me from my screen. So I have 2 years or so of me sitting in front of a computer looking kind of dazzled or smiling sometimes, but mostly it's a little... the computer face of like non-emotion, intellectual overwhelm, sometimes eyes furrowed. Anyway, it's a fun timeline, so I'll release it at some point, just these photos of every single commit. But it is interesting to see that even though that creation is all over the place and he fixes bug at 11 o'clock at night and stuff, these ideas that this is happening almost all remotely from each other, right? It's not like people are sitting in a room developing together most of the time. At Apple, I'm sure there's rooms of development, but most of the time, open source projects are totally done independent from each other, sitting on a couch at home, on a couch, you know.
Sure, sure.
In front of fire, whatever.
And yet this is the way to see how everyone is together.
Yeah. So the video is up, of course, on Vimeo because it's a beautiful video and therefore it goes on Vimeo and not YouTube.
No compression artifacts.
Doesn't Vimeo have like a style of the films? I'm not talking like the quality of the video. I'm talking about the quality of the cinematography. Like if you watch a YouTube video and you watch a Vimeo video, the Vimeo videos are like prettier. Why is that?
Because you generally have to pay for space. I mean, if you're going to use it in any significant amount, you're going to have to pay for it. And you're not going to just put up, you know, YouTube videos.
Right. I see. A friend of mine was just telling me that the way he deals with all his video of it that he makes is he doesn't back it up himself. He uploads all of it to YouTube in using secret links or private links or non-shareable or, you know, private, basically. And that's the way he backs up his video.
So when you download your own video from YouTube,
I think you can get the source back, yeah.
It is the source?
Well, maybe a compressed version. But then again, you know, you're talking about little cameras. I don't know.
I'm an archivist. I've got to have that original bits.
Absolutely. What about you, Miles? Do you do a lot of video?
I don't, as a matter of fact.
Still picture.
I mean, I do take video on my phone, but I never edit. And I don't really upload it very often. It's very much home videos and things of my daughter, and I don't necessarily need to share that. It's stuff for us. As long as I have it backed up.
I realized I love the beginning, taking pictures and taking video, and I love the very end, sharing with other people. But the middle part?
You mean those hours of sitting there tagging your photos?
Tagging photos. Of course, Lightroom 6, the new version of Lightroom, which I've got, allows face detection and auto naming of people, which has changed my life. Now I just have to go through 200,000 photos.
The default Photos app.
Yeah, but Photos app is lame, Apple. I mean, comparatively for my professional.
For some of us who don't take that many photos and videos, it's adequate.
It's adequate. Hey, you listen to Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell with Miles Elam and Brian Young, and we'll be right back. You're listening to Geek Speak on Independent Public Radio, KOSP. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me is Brian and Miles. We talked about Swift and Apple's little baby, and of course, Brian and I are developing Apple software all the time. So I think it's only fair to take a shout out to another language. Miles,
yes, Perl 6 has been released.
That's still around?
Okay. So what was it? I was using Perl 5 when I was learning Perl 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Perl 6 5 had just come out when I first started using Perl.
Development on Perl 6 was announced 15 years ago.
What have they been doing?
typing very slowly.
I love that other languages have emerged since then and gone out of fashion since then.
Well, and languages that were sort of somewhat inspired by Perl. I mean, it wasn't PHP sort of coming out of that
Yes,
world?
Very much so.
Yeah.
The syntax is almost identical for the basic functions.
So, okay, what's Perl good for? What kind of language is Perl?
Perl is a programming language written by a linguist.
Wait, I can't even understand English. So does that mean I can't understand Perl?
Well, some would say that it's a write once, read never language. But and that much of the code looks like line noise from a modem. But in Perl's defense, that line noise usually has to do with regular expressions, which is one of the reasons why Perl became so popular, and actually one of the reasons why regular expressions became so popularized with every language. Perl is really the first one that
reason I'm pretty good at regular expressions, I can read them the second time sometimes, is because of my experience with Perl. You just get good at it when you're dealing with Perl because you're doing it all the time, especially when you don't have like template languages or anything. You're just writing your own. But what's the new feature of Perl 6? Like, what do they got that's new and special? Just give me one thing and then so we can move on, please.
Okay. Well done, Unicode support.
Oh, they have Unicode
better support with native libraries, like native back and forth between Perl and other languages.
Awesome. All right. Thanks. Let's talk about net neutrality.
Okay. Shall we?
Can you tell me what the heck it is?
Okay. So this is kind of an end of the year show, right?
It is.
Although I guess some people will hear this in the new year.
It could be a beginning of the year or an end of the year.
A lot of shows like us would be doing sort of retrospectives of the last year. And in some ways, I guess this kind of is, because we've talked about net neutrality a fair bit over this last year. In fact, over the last couple of years, it's come up a lot. But I'm going to talk about net neutrality, a new twist on it that I want everyone to think about. Net neutrality is this concept that, what's the best way to explain it? It's the concept that your internet access is the same as anybody else's, no matter who your provider is and no matter which website you're going to, no matter which web service you're using. But it gets really nebulous on defining this.
Well, net neutrality doesn't refer to different providers. Like one ISP could say they have faster speeds for a better price than another ISP, and that doesn't affect net neutrality at all. But it treats the internet access like a utility.
Right, right.
In other words, a dumb
pipe.
Yeah, as opposed to it would be akin to PG&E, Pacific Gas and Electric out here on the West Coast, providing the electricity, which is always on 110, 115 volt house current. And then the opposite of net neutrality being the equivalent of PG&E provides power for certain devices, but then if you plug another type of device in that's using the exact same amount of voltage or current, they're going to charge more.
In other words,
PG&E branded.
Right. You can run toasters and you can run, water boiling pots for one price. But if you're going to plug a refrigerator in, you're going to pay double. That would be against the idea of net neutrality.
So if we go for a different metaphor of like phone service, traditional phone service, if I was calling the United States versus you calling the United States, we theoretically should be charged the same. Is that comparable?
I would think more along the lines of if you used a Pachelbel sponsored telephone, that the sound was clearer, even though there was nothing different about the line. And it wasn't really a difference in the quality of the phones. It was they had a deal, and make sure that the quality was prioritized for one group versus another.
Yeah, I think the metaphor is not very strong. I don't feel like we're clarifying it very much.
Well, let me put it a different way, because what is important about net neutrality? The businesses and the services that have built up around the internet in the 20 years since it's been popularized. Things like Google or things like Flickr, Tumblr, YouTube, all these services, especially something like YouTube that is really heavy on data usage, or Netflix, mm-hmm. All these things we enjoy now, they come out of an environment where any tiny startup any two-man, one-man shop can grow into these big companies, and they're on a level playing field with all the other existing services and companies. If they have a better idea, they execute well, and they can become popular.
An example would be like Craigslist, right? It started up by one person who was like, oh, I should make a list of stuff that's available to trade or sell. And so he put up a website. I can't remember Craig's last name, but Craigslist is this guy, Craig. And he hosted it from his house for a while and then finally put it in an ISP. And over time, it is now kind of the de facto place to trade goods in certain areas, which is kind of amazing.
Right, right. So that's possible because there's no entrenched rules about the internet that are preventing somebody from doing something
like
this.
It's an even playing field.
Even playing field. Now, one of the scenarios that's been talked a lot about that people feel is against this idea of net neutrality is some service, maybe a video service, being forced by ISPs or making deals with ISPs to pay the ISP, pay your internet provider so that they can get faster connections to the person who's watching the video.
Well, one thing that is coming up right now with mobile carriers is saying if you watch videos from these providers, it doesn't go against your data cap.
Well, that's actually where I'm going, which this is a new twist. This whole idea that you can get some services for a different price. And in this case, a different price means you're not paying a data charge for watching the video. So there's a lot of video providers that have done this with T-Mobile. They call it their all access. It's an all-you-can-eat service where if you go to that certain video provider, you get to watch all the videos you want. And T-Mobile imposes some rules on their partner on what videos go through. They encode the videos so that they're at what they call DVD quality. This is a 480p video instead of being able to watch HD video. But of course, since you are making that compromise that you're getting a lower quality video, they're able to give it to you for no extra charge. No, it doesn't go to your data cap. So you could watch hours and hours and hours, and you're not paying extra for that.
That sounds awesome for consumers.
It does sound awesome. And it's the exact kind of fruit that people are going to be really lured by.
So the reason why a telco decides to do this is that they therefore are going to get more signups and more people will sign up for their service. So
right.
Who's offering this? Like Verizon's offering this?
No. This is offered by T-Mobile, but different carriers have different twists on this idea.
So T-Mobile says, oh my gosh, if we say to people you can watch as much YouTube and Netflix as you want on your phone and that doesn't go against your data caps, and then there's also data caps after that, for a person who's frustrated with data caps and watches a lot of YouTube or Netflix, that's like a perfect incentive for them to buy the service.
Right.
So it seems to work really great for the two, you know, YouTube, and for Google and for Netflix, and then it works great for the consumer who wants to watch those things, and the T-Mobile gets a new customer. What's the downside?
Well, let's think through this. Once we get entrenched services like this, sure, we're getting the innovation of pricing, and sure, we're getting the services that we want that we know of right now. The problem is that these partners may be forced to pay T-Mobile to be a part of this program.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that they're doing that, but that is the way these kind of business models possibly can go. So once you have entrenched partners like that, then a new service that could be really innovative and
Miles Awesome Cat Videos.
Yeah, exactly. And you know the internet runs on cat videos. So when that starts up, they're going to have a larger barrier of entry to
so the people
into
that might want to go take a look at this new video service would then all of a sudden incur all these costs. It'd be a disincentive because their ISP wouldn't waive the data. So all of a sudden the cat videos of Miles, that service, just can't get the kind of attention that the other entrenched companies can get.
Right. Yeah. And right now you may consider that Netflix and YouTube together, for example, just to throw out some names, would be a good deal. And they're some of the most popular providers right now. But they weren't always.
Right.
And in the future, a company may decide, like AT&T may decide, you know what, I have this friend of mine who's starting a video business, so I'm going to give him a preferential deal. And he's competing with Netflix, so we're going to dump Netflix from that list. And now there's going to be this funneling mm-hmm. of customers basically to another service.
Right, a pure rational business choice.
So,
but Go on.
Yeah, so this T-Mobile deal, even though it sounds really great, actually is completely against the net neutrality concept.
Right. Yeah? So we're getting innovation in pricing, but we're taking the chance at losing innovation in the future services and the future businesses that could be built up around an open internet.
The thing I don't understand about T-Mobile saying, well, and it's unlimited data caps for these services. How can they do that? Because still, that's still like full-time video from two different providers. That's a lot of bandwidth. Why don't they just say all internet video is fine? Like, how does it benefit T-Mobile to list specific carriers and not just say you get free data?
Well, in their plan, it's because they're able to make sure that the videos that go through are dramatically lower data rates. So, I mean, DVD quality is much less data than we're used to seeing nowadays.
Well, that doesn't sound like something that we'd be into here at Netflix, I mean, because we want to have high-quality video.
Exactly.
I mean, we do a lot of work to get that to happen. So yeah, I'm assuming that I don't know how they're doing the force. Maybe it is a relationship I'm not aware of. How you force downgrade.
Well, they partner with T-Mobile, and then they make sure that they provide a stream that's specifically for the T-Mobile carriers.
No, I know how I would implement it here at Netflix. I get that.
Yeah.
I'm saying that I don't think we do that. I'm not aware if we do.
Oh, right.
I don't think we have a relationship with T-Mobile. I could be wrong. I could ask around. But I think that it's T-Mobile that's doing it, but I could be incorrect about that as well. If you do reduce your bandwidth, you will get... You know, you'll still get functioning video that's downgraded in quality.
Yeah.
We have that. It's called adaptive streaming.
As a side note, there was an accusation. I don't know if anybody's gotten to the bottom of it. There's an accusation that YouTube, which is not a part of T-Mobile's plan, is being downgraded as well for all T-Mobile users, just as a part of the system, which would... You know, that would be meddling with the request for the video, which is no-no.
Well, I guess. I mean, I'm assuming that the higher bandwidth you have on any of these video services, the higher quality bitrate you'll get. And that means better quality video. Normally.
If the user's in control, yeah.
But no, I'm saying that the data package you have, the antenna you've got, the network connection you have, you know, if all my friends come over and we all watch independent videos from my, you know, good Comcast video cable connection, network connection, at some point we're still downgrading. We won't get enough bandwidth through and we will see lower quality streams. So the connection quality, you know, you hear LGE, different types of terminology for your antenna or your bandwidth.
LTE.
LTE, thanks. That definitely does modify the video feed that you get.
Right. Yeah. And maybe that's what people are seeing.
So you brought this up kind of in the guise of net neutrality. So help me understand. You think that we went through the whole political bickering thing and we got to the place where there seems to be support to have net neutrality kind of be a reality. And yet here's T-Mobile and other companies doing something that seems to be good for most people right off the bat, which would be hard to fight in you know, it's T-Mobile's company. They can decide what they want to do kind of thing.
They can, but we as consumers need to decide what kind of internet we want as well. So I'm a big supporter of T-Mobile. I wish I could use their service up in the mountains where I am. But these kind of business innovations, I don't want them to destroy the spirit of the internet that we've grown up with. There's no reason why the internet that we've had for the last 20 years is going to stay the way it is. Lots of young industries started off with lots of innovation and then reached a point where the big entrenched interests
owned the space
yeah. And the innovation crawled to a halt.
The automobile industry in the United States is a perfect example. There used to be a lot of people making cars.
Right.
And now there's not. There's a few corporations making them. So it's interesting because from a mobile carrier perspective, I don't find it very offensive. But if you told me that the connection I get at my house through Comcast or AT&T DSL was limited by target location, I would get really angry. Like, well, it seems to me there's a dichotomy for me about that.
And what about Comcast's offering where they will give you a different – they will not apply to your data cap, your data rate, any video that they're providing through their service. Uh-huh. You pay for per megabyte for Netflix or for YouTube videos, but their video service, which they say never goes over the internet, of course it doesn't because it's going from their system to your router, to your cable modem, you're not getting any data charges on that. So
does Comcast have data caps?
They do that they don't enforce. they occasionally run tests where they do turn on the enforcement in different markets and see whether they can get away with it, sure, or whether people start finding some other ISP somehow, which is the problem. All of this would be much less of a problem if we had better competition for broadband internet. Mm-hmm. And I want to say, even if we had better competition for our cellular networks, it's funny. I mean, we have four national carriers, and yet it's the competition that is making T-Mobile seek out these kind of plans, and I'm worried about them eroding what we love about the internet. So I wish there was some way that we, as consumers, we could push all of these services just to be a dumb pipe, to be the utility that allows us to get onto the internet. And I'm worried about any innovation in changing that.
You know, I've got to say that though I seem to give a pass to these telco companies because of this idea that, well, it's an extra fee and there's costs associated with the bandwidth that I use on that network, so I know it's different. The truth is, more and more, the primary source of communication, especially globally, is through mobile carriers. So that is the place we need to protect in the sense of open web.
Yeah.
Right. If we don't do that, we're talking about the future of most people on the planet will be mobile only. That's their way, their data band. In some places, I think my home actually get better network through my cable provider, but it's close. LTE is pretty fast speeds, and so sometimes I'll switch over to my cell phone just to make sure to get data.
Sure, and that's what I expect the biggest level of competition for cable providers will be.
So how do we fight this, Brian? How do we push back and say, look, no, we've got to have open, free communication?
Well, there's two things going on. Number one, most important thing is consumers. But I don't know if we'll reach enough consumers from our little microphones here. But I really want consumers to think about what they are getting for their money and what they want out of their services so that they shop for the service that they want.
Okay, but if you could get T-Mobile right now, would you get that plan?
No, I would not get that plan. I don't want to support that plan.
Okay. So don't support these plans where the data that you get to is managed by the provider you have, because what that does is it empowers the provider to take your use of the internet and muscle it against people that are being creative on the internet. That's a good way to sum it up, I guess.
Now, the FCC does have some authority in this area.
Yeah.
And they are looking into, they just started a probe, and they're looking into Comcast and T-Mobile and AT&T over these kind of cap exemptions. So there is some role that government has to play here. And depending on your politics, that's a good or a bad thing. But those are the two things going on. More importantly, I just think every consumer should actually know what they're getting into,
Absolutely.
What kind of bargaining they're setting up.
Well, that's why you're listening to GeekSpeak. Hey, if you want to chat with us offline, you're welcome to do so anytime. You can contact us on Twitter, on Facebook. We are KUSP Geeks. And of course, we also receive email and read all the email. And some of us actually respond to a lot of it. We're at geekspeak.org. We're just geeks@geekspeak.org. And of course, everything we talk about here on the program, we have links and more stories, more information up at geekspeak.org. We'll be right back here on KUSP. It's GeekSpeak on 88.9 KUSP and KUSP.org. I'm Lyle Troxell. I'm speaking with Brian Young and Mr. Miles Elam. Miles, we talked a bit about net neutrality. I think another thing we should probably talk about is copyright.
Yes. There was a funny thing that happened not too long ago, which is there was a Walmart in part of the country that jumped the gun in selling Star Wars figures.
Star Wars figures.
Yes. Before the movie had been released. Which means that those figures that come out are going to be spoilers.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Because they're characters you've never seen before or
whatever.
How many days are we talking about? Did they jump the gun?
It was a few days or two a week.
There were some lucky kids in that area. I'll tell you. And when I say kids, I mean people exactly like me at my age.
So this individual bought a figure, paid the $6.50, almost $7. So much more expensive than when I was a kid, but then again, inflation. And took a photo of it and posted it on Facebook.
Okay.
Disney makes a Digital Millennium Copyright Act claim over the Star Wars figure pick.
Wait, the photograph of something he bought at a store?
Yes.
They're doing a copyright infringement act on it.
Yes. The Walmart's release the figures too early, but he bought it. He went in there. He bought it. He paid money. It's his figure. No one's taking it back from him. Great. Took a photo of it. Posting it up on Facebook means that it violates copyright.
No.
But we love the DMCA. The DMCA has helped us out so much in the digital age.
No, it hasn't. It's horrible law.
And Facebook – well, no, it's not
DMCA
a horrible law.
DMCA is the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and it has some ramifications that geeks normally don't like very much.
Well, it did some good things in that copyright law did not take the internet into account at all.
Right.
But it also tried to take – what is the physical space for copyright, what we've always done with and tried to apply it to the internet, which doesn't always function the same.
Well, this idea that Disney, which owns the copyright of these characters in the Star Wars universe, then creates a toy or probably creates some company that then creates the toy, puts it at Walmart and gives Walmart the right to sell it, which I'm sure there's legal ramifications, licensing it. Walmart messes up on that contract, sells it to an individual, and then the individual's creative endeavors are suppressed by Disney. So that's the part that I don't like about this. The person took a photograph. Anytime you – and that they're thereby and made a statement, they're presenting themselves. The photograph that person made is a copyrighted work as well, automatically by the rules of copyright in the United States. But more importantly than that, that person's expressing themselves in society, right? She or he is taking a photograph and making a statement and representing I am part of our culture and this is one of things I think about. That is their voice and their engagement with society. And to then smother that because of some legal ramification of two other companies seems ridiculous.
So Disney files the DMCA takedown notice to Facebook. Facebook takes down the photos and all the people who shared that photo.
Facebook's got to protect itself.
Right. The person goes, wait, this is completely unacceptable. I bought it. It's mine. I'm going to post it again. This time, Facebook removed the entire post, not just the photo, and banned the user from posting to the site for 3 days.
Just to be clear, this must have been a public post, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
But wait a second. Does Facebook have to – like that photograph – Does Disney have any claim to that photograph? I don't see how that Disney could have any claim to that photograph. That's like saying I get pajamas, Disney pajamas, and put them on my kids, and then I put a picture of my kids up on Facebook. Then they're wearing the pajamas. Then Disney, for some reason, can take down my photograph? I mean, if made items in the world, they can't claim those items can't be in a photograph, can they?
Except there, here's the question. I mean, this gets very muddy where – let's say you have something that is private to you and someone who has access to your house or whatever takes a photo of that contrary to your wishes.
So and let's then say posts I've painted a photograph. I've painted a painting. I've put it in my hallway. You break into my house.
And you plan on displaying that painting.
In 6 months.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. I'm
gonna sell it. In a couple of weeks.
I'm going to sell it. It's going to be amazing. And then for some reason you come into my home because you need to borrow something and you take a photograph.
Well, no. You're the contracted photographer. And you take the photos and it's agreed upon. It's like Walmart selling the figures. Like you've agreed to that.
Okay.
But you haven't released the photos yet. Okay. You've been told by contract not to release the photos yet. To start selling them, selling copies of them.
I kind of understand. I'm going to go off in a different way. Mm-hmm. I kind of understand Facebook's perspective, of course, because Facebook is making money off of things that get posted on their service, right? The way they make money is through advertising. So everything that's on Facebook, Facebook makes money from. And therefore, they're making money off of Disney's intellectual property.
Mm-hmm.
That's Disney's perspective, right? Because that photo's not available. The only reason Disney doesn't do that on every single photograph of a person wearing Disney pajamas, Mickey Mouse pajamas, is because that would be bad for Disney, right? It's not because they couldn't do the same claim. Anytime there's a trademark thing especially, but a copyrighted work that's reproduced in some fashion and then people are making money off that reproduction, the owner of the copyright could say, no, that's not okay. And that's why we don't see Disney figurine, Star Wars figurines in a movie because the movie's – unless the movie is being is licensing that because the movie's going to make money off it. And that's why you have like fake products sometimes or shirts that blurred out on the television.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about this copyright and especially trademark infringement. But I don't understand, is that true if any time you represent work that has other people's copyright material in it, that can occur?
Yeah. Think of, this is now ancient history, it seems, the iPhone 4 was was stolen from a bar.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And a company went and looked through and goes, hey, we have all these new things. And, oh, look at this. Before the phone, you know, bricked itself remotely. And they took photos of that phone and then posted it up on their website saying, hey, we got the scoop. We found it. Under the these terms, like, why is that not copyright infringement? It was considered newsworthy.
Yeah. Well,
but if an individual person goes like, hey, I was able to get this from a Walmart who gave it out early.
Did Disney drop this case finally? Did they finally let it go? Is it posted? I guess
once the movie
got
released,
then no one cared about it.
Right.
Right. That was their intention, was just to use the law to
delay it.
Yeah. Not to win the case. But I mean, that's the whole problem with the DMCA's enforcement mechanisms, is that that's totally possible.
Well, it does presume guilt.
Yes.
Rather than innocence. Yeah.
Oh, goodness. But, you know, the person who bought that has absolutely no blame in this and shouldn't have any limits on them. It's completely on Walmart, isn't it?
It starts really just questioning how much we take. I mean, this idea of cultural ownership and who owns what is really fascinating when it comes to copyright. Like the idea of copyright, of course, was to empower people that have creativity to have a limited amount of time where they can actually benefit financially from their creativity, and thereby ensuring that we have a creative society, right? That's the whole point behind it. And so the situation where the corporation is kind of going, no, can't do this yet, and kind of limiting someone else's creativity is the part that kind of irks me. It shouldn't work that way.
Well, combined with people being born after Steamboat Willie was released, living a full and complete life where they do not die prematurely. And once they die, they still have never seen a Mickey Mouse in the public domain, like in any form.
What you're basically saying is it's not limited if it keeps on going.
Right.
If an entire lifespan goes without it having access to these cultural artifacts, then they are not – it's not limited.
Right. How can you define it as limited when the laws refer to human beings?
Well, so we move on from this. Let's talk about maybe some gifts that the kids got this holiday.
So did we talk – we didn't talk about the Hour of Code earlier in the month, did we?
No, we didn't. We covered it really well last year, but we didn't cover it this year.
Yeah, yeah. So it's this whole concept of something to promote the idea of teaching kids or really anybody how to code. And we've talked about the merits of that before. But what was interesting here is my kids got a little gift this year that I was really fascinated with. Is these they call them little robots. Ozobots is the brand name. I don't know if robot's the right term. What it is a little device that can roll around on the ground. It has wheels. It looks circular itself, but it has a flat bottom, so it has wheels.
It's a toy.
It's a toy. Okay. And it's got little lights on the top. And that's all there is to it, is it can drive itself around and it can flash its lights in different patterns. There's I don't know how many different colors. But there's all sorts of ways to program this robot. And the one that fascinates me the most is a teaming up that this company did with Google using their Blockly language.
Uh-huh.
Have you ever seen Blockly?
Yeah, yeah. It reminds me of other languages like this. Miles, you want to take a look at it?
Yeah, it's really similar to something else my kids play with, which is called Hopscotch. It uses a visual way to represent some concepts that we use in programming all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very approachable, and you can lay these little blocks out on the page on your computer.
So you have computer software, and you're throwing blocks in like turn left or turn right or wait 3 seconds. And you
or
have
accelerate.
These little, accelerate, or, you have these little blocks. And then at some point after you kind of got it running, you say, go. And it sends that command to the bot, to the little robotic shot putt. It looks like a
it looks like an ice puck,
kind of.
Yeah, it's actually really tiny.
It's really small.
It's about the size of a quarter.
Okay.
As far as its footprint. Yeah, it does. In fact, the way it gets the instructions to the robot, to the Ozobot, is really cool. You take it and you put it on the screen, and it flashes the instructions in different color codes.
Awesome.
And that's how it uploads it.
Yeah, this is cool. This is the software equivalent of Snap Circuits.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, cool. But all of a sudden,
Ozobot.
All of a sudden, Ozobot. Programming is not just this screen time activity that I worry about as a parent, where my kids are doing nothing active. It starts bringing the computer into the physical world, where they actually have a physical manifestation of all their thought and all their little play on the computer.
So if you'd done things like pulled out Legos or dominoes and had a maze and had the thing go through and knock things down, that kind of stuff?
Sure, you can make games like that.
Oh, cool.
They show on their video somebody playing around with tiny bowling pins and
you can
they instructed how to knock over all the pins, even though it wouldn't be possible with a real bowling ball.
Oh, cool. You can see more about this from geekspeak.org. The toy is called Ozobot. Awesome. You know, I just realized, guys, that after we record the full hour of Geek Speak for broadcast, that we could talk about Star Wars and just do a big spoiler alert before we do that. So we might do that at the end of the show. So do listen to the end of the show, especially if you're on radio, though. You have to go to geekspeak.org and subscribe to our podcast, which you can do from anywhere. And please do, because the more people that subscribe and comment on our podcast, especially on iTunes service, the more people find it. So it would be great if you wanted to do that. All right. Miles, you want to talk about?
Yeah, hard geeky right turn.
R-Sync?
Yes.
You know, I just needed R-Sync recently because I kept on having my NAS device kept on disconnecting its AFP connection. And so I was like, oh, I should just set up an R-Sync because that way this R-Sync service keeps going and I won't have this problem.
And you had a whole bunch of people out there listening going,
yes.
AFP.
Apple File Protocol.
R-Sync is a system in which you can sync file systems between two different places. So it's great for backups. Like actually, in fact, a lot of backups, if you get a hard drive and it has a backup solution on it, what's really going on is it's rsync is running. And it basically goes, is this file the same as that file? Oh, it isn't. Let's move it over. And that's kind of what rsync does. But go on.
Right. But there's a company called rsync.net that is offering ZFS replication to the cloud. Right.
What's ZFS?
ZFS is a file system, usually file system. Okay, file systems always are not sexy, but file systems are a way to organize the data that's on your hard drive. The reason that you know that you have directories or folders and files and different file types and when those files were updated, their last modified date, is because there's a file system that's keeping track of all that information.
Also, when you take a file, like a Word document or something, and you move it from one folder to the other, you're actually not moving bits around. You're moving the directions in the file system to say, this file's now at this location. So the file system actually is the virtualization of data.
Right. You're not just writing to a hard drive or an SSD drive or some other storage as a big bunch of ones and zeros. That may end up being kind of what it ends up – it may be what it is at the bottom end of it, but there are a bunch of layers in between, one of them being the file system.
Okay.
And before you go on, because what you're about to talk about seems really cool, I just want to point out the file system is one of these parts of a computer that is so important that the tiniest bug will make anybody's life absolutely miserable. This is your data. This is your photos. This is everything. And even though – all those bits could be written down to the file system. If one little thing about how that file system stores where that data is gets corrupted, things go completely haywire. And over the years, we've gotten much more robust file systems. Yeah. And I don't know. There hasn't been a lot innovation on file systems.
There has been. ZFS was actually a big jump up. That's the thing.
To be clear, though, ZFS is also a file system, but it's also a logical file volume manager.
Right.
So it's a little different.
The thing about file systems, just like you were saying, Brian, about any small change, any small problem could be catastrophic. That's why they tend to be so boring, because anyone who works on file systems has to be extremely careful and conservative in what they do and the changes they make. ZFS was a way to try to resolve some of the what were considered inherent problems with a file system. Many people have a RAID system, multiple disks that have a single file system, oftentimes employing a logical volume manager like mm-hmm. Lyle was talking about. And so you'd have one piece of hardware that handles the RAID, and then you'd have a logical volume manager, which was another piece of software that goes on top of that. And then you put a file system on top of the logical volume manager, and then you ran your applications on top of the file system.
What could go wrong?
Right. So ZFS was a way to address all of that, trying to compress those into a single piece so that you didn't have this mismatch where one hand didn't know what the other hand was doing.
ZFS stands for, by the way, the Z file system. FS stands for file system. Most file systems have the FS in the name of them. And ZFS was originally developed by Sun, and now it's an open source project.
Right. One of the cool things about ZFS is that similar to Git, it makes a checksum of each file. So not only when the file is on there can you can it say like, oh, yes, my file is there. I'm going to read it. That's fine. It can also check it to see, did anything go wrong with this file?
Right. Cool.
So those videos that I've had on my drive for literally 10 years that are sitting there, and every once in a while I pull them up just to see whether they still play. And every once in a while I do find one that's completely corrupted, and I realize for the last 5 years I've been backing up that corrupted one.
Oh.
That's not possible?
Well, yeah. What happens is you have a RAID system, and it's on multiple drives. So you have, like, for example, with RAID 5, a parity bit along striped across all those drives. And so if ZFS goes through and tries to read the data and then goes, hey, wait a second, this doesn't match up with my checksum, it can then go, oh, well, let me try to calculate what is the correct value, and then reconstruct it in another part of the drive so that it saves the data.
Okay, so what's the ZFS replication to the cloud? What does this mean?
Yeah, didn't you just love it? Okay, we had this much time just to do the preamble to it. So rsync, you were talking about as, yes, as a way to do that. Rsync is great. And before it was the fastest way you could do it. Instead, but what rsync had to do is it had to calculate with each file every single time it ran, what's the checksum on this? What's the checksum on this? What's the checksum on this? And then send the data over. So it's a large amount of data going over the wire and slows it down. ZFS already has that checksum. So all it has to do, similar to Git, is send over the hash, the checksums for the whole thing, and then goes, oh, just this one thing changed. Let me just send that.
So it's basically an rsync helping ZFS helping rsync do a better job at what it does.
Yes, just like ZFS helped RAID do a better job, and just like ZFS made the file system do a better job.
Cool. So rsync.net's providing this capability?
Yes.
Do you run ZFS on your file system for
your
Mac? Is anybody? Can you run it on a Mac?
No, I think it's well,
they were planning on it. Yeah, they were planning on it, and they did have it for a while, but it never went mainstream.
I believe they actually took that out too. It was just in previews. But yeah, it's a Linux system.
Well, no, Linux.
You can do it on Windows?
You can do it on Linux, but it's a bit hard. FreeBSD is really where you would do that. The BSDs.
GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence, who's used with permission, and GeekSpeak of Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. So use our stuff any way you'd like. You can even make money on it. Just let them know the Geek said hi. This is Independent Public Radio, 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz, and streaming live worldwide at KUSP.org. To find out more about this or any episode of GeekSpeak, please visit us at geekspeak.org. If you understand what we were talking about with ZFS and rsync, please email us and let us know, geeks@geekspeak.org, and we'll keep on being that geeky. Our theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. I'm Lyle Troxell with Miles Elam and Brian Young. GeekSpeak is produced by me, and thanks to Chandler, our intern, and our Canadian correspondent, Greg Merkley, and thank you for being here for GeekSpeak. We'll see you next week. And, oh, Miles and Brian, thanks so much.
Yeah, it was great.
Always a pleasure.
Talk about Star Wars now? For the podcast, that is?
Sure.
All right. Okay.
You offer to do this on the day that we all have to run from lunch?
Do you guys have to run?
I really should.
Okay. Chandler and Greg, have you guys seen Star Wars?
I have not yet.
You have not seen it, Greg?
I have not yet.
Oh.
Well, you better hang up now.
you better hang up. We'll call you back, okay?
It's okay.
All right. Has he hung up yet? I really can't say what I'm about to say. Okay, this is a total spoiler alert. You cannot listen to this if you haven't seen the Star Wars movie. We're not going to talk about anything else on this episode of GeekSpeak. Please just, if you haven't seen it, just stop listening, skip this episode, delete it from your podcast.
Or if you don't want to hear commentary on Star Wars.
Yeah, just stop. You don't need to listen to this. Just skip it. Close it down. This is a spoiler alert for the Star Wars Episode 7. We're going to talk about stuff you don't want to hear about.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Are you okay with Han dying?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Okay with it?
I thought it was highly telegraphed, though.
It was highly telegraphed. You knew it was going to happen. He's like, here, you take the detonator. Come on.
Actually, I thought just about everything about it was very predictable.
Yeah. Well, if you see our son, you talk to him.
Yeah, but the reason why you see a Star Wars movie is not for its level of unpredictability.
On the contrary. Empire Strikes Back was wonderful.
That was
you
great.
Find out,
and now,
wait, Vader's his father? Wait, Han is put into carbonite? Like, is frozen? What?
Wait, you didn't know? Wait, before you saw that, you didn't know that Vader was Luke's father?
So out of 7 movies, there's one huge surprise, and now you expect each one of them to carry those?
But
you're right, though. It was way too telegraphed. Yeah, I agree. I didn't need to be telegraphed.
So Finn crash lands. Okay, the pilot is gone. Okay, it actually does a pretty good job there.
Do you think he died?
I actually thought he died.
I want to know how the jacket got off of him, and yet he was nowhere near the
Because he reached into the cockpit and it was there.
I don't think he was wearing the jacket, but I haven't seen the movie the second time. I gotta see if he's wearing it. Yeah. If he wasn't wearing it, then it's totally fine.
But that whole thing, it was sinking quickly, had to come out, and then there's an explosion. I thought, it was like, oh, well.
that's pretty tight.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's, if you thought about it, if you had time to think about it in the film, you'd realize that he was alive because we didn't see his body. And you see bodies all the time. So it's not like, the only reason to hide it is because it wasn't there. I mean, that from my perspective, it was obvious, but only in retrospect, in the sense that I didn't think about it or care about it. And I didn't recognize it was him. I didn't recognize the actor while he's like shooting around and being an amazing pilot and doing things that would destroy a human brain like easily because the G's that are happening, you're like, yeah, okay.
That's what I meant, like subluminous ether. There's stuff going on that is not classic physics.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
But in general, I really enjoyed the film. I was so – the thing I said at the very end of it, I think, was, well, Merry Christmas to all of us, because it did feel like, okay, good. It was good. Well, like, okay, I was worried about it.
Okay, there are so many problems with the film, but fundamentally, this thing is the first Star Wars movie that's been made since 1983.
That's any good.
No. I mean, the prequels do not feel like Star Wars right. when you compare them to this and the ones that we grew up with.
Well, if you talk to our children, though, you'd
disagree. Oh, of course. They believe it's all one thing, and they don't even care about the order we
I was pleasantly surprised that there was so much – that Han and Leia were so much a part of the show. I didn't expect that at all. At the same time, I didn't feel like there was a lot of depth in Han. Han's young cockiness, he's still young and cocky 20 years later or 18 years later or whatever.
Well, that's just a little – other than the wrinkles and the gray hair, nothing seemed to have changed
exact same character.
In 20-some years.
Which is maybe fine. You know, it's a space opera. No. Who cares if it doesn't change?
All right. So I was sad about every part that was Han and Leia.
Yeah.
If they reduced them to just cameos, I would have been happy.
So – Let's take some votes here, or take some bets. Who here thinks that Rey's last name is going to end up being Skywalker?
No.
Totally.
You don't think it's going to be Solo?
No, I think it's going to be Skywalker.
Why not Solo?
The fact that...
Or what's Leia's last name?
Organa.
I mean, it's possible, right? So in the books... In the books, Han and Leia have twins. Like, that's set. I mean,
No. The books are not canon.
Yeah. I know. I totally get that. But Ben's in that, too. One of their sons is named Ben, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's part of it, too. So you could assume that.
But it was Luke's son that was Ben.
But the other thing is, it doesn't make sense to have Han and Leia name their son Ben. Han didn't even really like Ben very much, and Leia never met him, right? So it makes more sense for Luke to have the kid that is after Han, unless Leia actually gets after the last film, after the episode 6, Leia actually has enough Force awareness to see Ben in post, in Force Ghost, whatever the heck that is. So it's possible she had a relationship with that stage and that we don't know about it. Then you could kind of name your son after him. But anyway, thoughts? I've been wanting to talk to people about this so much.
I just want to go see it again.
No, honestly, I think that the reason Rey was dropped off on that planet and she hasn't seen anyone was because she was one of the only survivors of the Kylo Ren massacre.
Mm-hmm.
And Luke sends his daughter off. And that's why at the end when she's holding up the lightsaber and she's getting all teary-eyed and he's not saying anything is they have a recognition that they know each other and – Oh
so
my
the,
God,
the other thing that releases her Force awareness quite a bit, like she becomes much more powerful in that sense, is having contact with him. So if they're twins, then it kind of makes sense to some level that would release something in her.
As opposed to what? Wonder Twin powers?
No, just that something has shut her down and forced her to stay on that planet,
yes,
right?
But Luke was awakened by simply being around Ben Kenobi.
That's
just
true.
Being around someone who's Force aware.
I agree. It definitely could just be that. So the other aspect of her being on the planet, though, and that she's so dedicated to staying there, is that dedication to staying there because someone told her with Force powers, stay here? Because it seems like she's very dedicated to waiting, right?
She wants her family.
Yeah, I thought that was well explained.
Does she remember her family really well? Because if she remembers her family really well, that would make a lot of sense to have such passion for that. If she's too young to remember her family very well, it doesn't make a lot of sense.
Wasn't the comment like she was 7 years old or something?
Yeah, it's pretty old. So if that's the case, then she would have recognized her mom, if her mom is Leia, unless they never saw each other after birth, which, you know, happens. Or at the very end, she would have been like, oh, hey, Dad, you left me on that planet, instead of, like, handing you a saber.
Except why would her mom never have seen her after her birth? Because she saw the sun. She knew who Ben was.
Okay, so the other aspect of this is that if you are able to tell that, you know, Anakin has all that stuff in the earlier, in the crap films, about seeing the future and scared about the death and all that stuff. So he has precognition. So that runs in the family in general. Luke could have precognition. So Luke, when Leia is pregnant, might understand that something horrible is going to happen to these kids, right? Or to his own kids, maybe, and has to hide his family. So in that situation, I could see Luke having precognition or Leia having precognition and going, okay, we're going to do something drastic, like abandon this child on the planet. Just seems kind of – you got to have some reason to do that to a child.
Okay. So switching gears.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we're going to agree to disagree here.
Yeah, you're good. And then wonderfully, we get to find out, which I love.
So Snoke, main evil dude.
Mm-hmm. The giant one, maybe?
Darth Plagueis?
What's Darth Plagueis? I didn't read the books.
The precursor to Palpatine. He's canon.
He's the one that tried to live forever?
Yeah, that had conquered death.
Oh my God. He conquered death and he's still around. That makes sense. Okay, yeah. I'll go
no wonder
with that.
The other Sith didn't work out.
So, okay, that's cool. I like that. What about the clones being gone? You cool with that? No more clones?
Yes.
All right, that was kind of cool. Do you think that guy is giant or small?
I don't know. I don't have a.
So in have you seen the Clone Wars animated series?
Yeah, most of it. Yeah.
Okay. So I went back and watched these.
Did you watch the Yoda
the four
ones?
The four that you told me. Yeah. About. They're the last four of the Clone series.
Are they the last four? I saw them. Oh, it's the only ones I've seen because I went to some event.
Right. Okay. It is the last four.
So the
they're Clone so over Wars, the top. They're wonderful.
Yeah. So the Clone Wars is an animated series available on Netflix that follows the Clone War time period, and it's a fun animated series. I think.
It's a long multi-season series, and then there's the Clone Wars movie. Animated movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I haven't seen that. Is that also available?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. And anyway, four episodes of this is about Yoda, and Yoda goes on a quest and actually finds like a source of the Force and also finds these ancient giant Force beings, right? People that deal with the Force that have giant – isn't it giant? Is that right, Brian?
Is what giant?
Doesn't Yoda go to a place where there's giant
– That's the thing. No, they're not.
Oh, they're not giant.
In fact, what they are is entirely Force beings that just have robes and a mask on them. So
No, I know that. But there's – I get the Force being space, but there's also a visit to these large sculptural stone – very much looked like the throne of that guy. What's the guy's name, the bad guy?
Snoke.
Snoke. You don't remember that?
I looked for anything large and giant.
Maybe
and
it's another. It's another episode.
Remembering something other.
Okay, so yeah, the Force. I don't want to ruin that aspect though, because if you haven't seen the Clone Wars animated series, the ones with Yoda, you say they're the last.
Yeah,
ones?
Except the last four. Yeah. Are the ones that
you should watch that. It's cool.
Had the whole storyline about Yoda and finding the origins of
yeah.
the thing.
Go take yeah. a look.
In cool. fairness, Clone Wars have been out for long enough now, even on Netflix, that I'm sorry if you got a spoiler, but they've
well,
been
no,
there
no,
for
that's
a while.
Fine. I'm just saying that I don't want to turn people off to that by talking about it if you haven't watched it, because we're going to keep watching about Star Wars. Are we done with Star Wars?
Hmm? Well, there was one aspect of Star Wars that really kind of bugged me.
Okay.
Yes, it was great to have a black stormtrooper. Where were the other black folks?
Oh, they all had masks on, didn't you know?
Apparently, they hadn't been taken from their planet and indoctrinated and turned into.
No, I mean like everywhere else in the galaxy.
I agree. I mean, it's like the first canon, right? There's only
one or two Asian guys through the whole movie.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
Okay, this is true. You're absolutely right. Although nobody looked at him oddly, thinking he was out of place. So there's that. That's a good thing, unfortunately, for us as
wow,
viewers.
He's not completely alien like a different species.
Of course, us as viewers don't get to enjoy that. I totally get it. You're absolutely right that it sticks out.
It definitely sticks out.
At the same time, what they did with the Rey character was absolutely wonderful when you start thinking about our role models of women in culture and how mm-hmm. it's going into films. So, yes, really bad on the race side, pretty good on the sex side, on the gender side.
Yeah, I'd agree. Mm-hmm. I think that she definitely is herself. You know, I mean, there's no – she, you know, growing up by herself, which is a little weird and creepy.
I was actually thinking the innkeeper – then Rey and yeah. Leia altogether had some pretty good role models.
Yeah. But think about it. Here's Rey on her planet dealing with people trying to steal BB-8, and she's not looking for anyone to help her. She's just doing what she does because she's competent at what she does.
Yeah.
And when the stormtrooper, I'm sorry, what's his name?
Finn.
When Finn tries to grab her hand to save this woman being attacked on her planet, she's just, what in the world are you taking my hand for?
Yeah, it's cool.
There is no concept of that.
So have you guys seen all the little Easter eggs?
No, I want to see it a second time to get that.
I don't know if you would get this one. You got where the name Finn came from, FN, right? Did you happen to notice that he was 2187?
No.
Do you know what 2187 is?
It sounds very familiar.
It has to do with the trash compactor.
What is 2187?
Well, it has to do with imprisoned.
That was Leia's cell on the original Death Star.
No way, really?
Yeah.
No, I did not know that. Okay, so what about this? It is the exact same movie as A New Hope.
Yes.
Person on a sand planet finds a robot that has a special map. They figure out that they have superpowers. They go and destroy a giant mega weapon by flying inside it. I mean, it's the same movie.
And the mentor figure meets an old nemesis and is killed in front of them, causing a trauma.
Yes, it is the exact same movie.
To then go across the galaxy in search of a wizened old teacher.
At the very end.
Okay, yes.
It's the same movie.
Well, that doesn't bug me nearly as much as seeing a sun sucked into a planet.
You don't like that?
No.
Just the mass perspective?
You don't like that?
No, not at all.
They have light travel capabilities. They can obviously harness. They have spatial dimensional
problems. Subluminous ether.
I can watch all of Star Wars and my suspension of disbelief is fine. But that, seeing the planet like—
It was a small sun?
Like one, not even a full sun width away from the surface of the sun, sucking it off.
Well, first off, you've seen that type of thing before by binary star systems, where one cannibalizes another.
Yeah.
I've seen that if they're spinning at high velocities and the other body is—
That can
is
happen kind of slowly.
But what happens if you have like a planetary size thing to have a magnetic field that you're affecting drawing all the
information? The issue is the mass.
Yes.
No, but I mean, like, take the sun and put it inside a planet. It doesn't make any sense.
Why not?
Because it's 10,000 size. You know, it's like giant.
You're talking about the size?
Yeah.
But the thing is, you turn that star into neutron material.
Okay.
So it's a much smaller.
So here's the question. You agree that the planet was orbiting that sun, right? So then you take the mass of the planet, you put it inside the planet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, mass of the sun and put it inside the planet.
Mm-hmm.
Can you walk on the planet anymore? No. You're flat.
Hey, hold on. First off, when you're walking around on spaceships in Star Wars, you have gravity.
That's true.
Why
is
that?
Because
they can control gravity, which is why the regulator, when it was blown on the planet, takes away the artificial gravity, which is a compensator, and suddenly it crushes in on itself because you have the force of a neutron star in the center.
I think it's okay. I think they've got the special capabilities.
That one stuck out too much.
Anything else you guys want to talk about?
I've heard the critique of people saying, how did Rey stand up to Kylo Ren, or Finn for
how
that matter?
How did Finn stand up to Kylo Ren? Yeah.
And
Kylo Ren was injured.
Yes. I like the fact that he was hit by Chewbacca's bowcaster.
Right.
He was hurt bad.
He was hurt bad, but he was still fighting pretty well. But also, at the very end of the battle,
he throws
Finn with force energy. He could have thrown Finn anytime he wanted with force energy. So the only reason the Emperor plays with Luke at the very end of the last movies that was any good is because he wants to torture him. He could have killed him instantaneously,
He
wants to turn him, but he also, like, the end is like, fine, then die. He wants to kill him, but he's going to do it slow and devious, right? It's about the joy of the pain. If Kylo Ren had that when he was fighting Finn, it would have made more sense.
Except that one of the things you need with force is focus. And while Kylo Ren is very rage-filled going toward the Sith, he is not focused. And he was in extreme amounts of pain.
Yes. Yeah. I get that.
Okay. Yeah, but I don't know.
I think Kylo Ren was a good character. I liked him a lot. I thought he was pretty...
Thank you. My name is Miles, Star Wars apologist Elam.
Yeah, you have apologized to a couple of things. Anything else? why does R2-D2 wake up?
Oh, Luke did that.
How does Luke do that?
Because Luke is tapped into the Force and he can feel that it's...
I think it's the lightsaber coming to the room.
Yeah, I think it was
that, that was Luke's instructions. When you see the lightsaber, wake your...
or when you sense the lightsaber, whatever. Yeah,
I think it was BB-8, the fact that you brought the missing piece of the map that R2 had the rest of.
They had it earlier in the scene. They had
But R2's an older model. He needs more boot up time.
Apologist.
Coming back from a C3 standby takes some time.
Okay, well, if you're going to apologize for that, then how about the whole political situation?
Yeah, what the hell is happening in this government? Have you figured that out yet?
George Lucas does not understand how governments work.
George Lucas that's the issue. He didn't write the film.
Oh, you're talking about this one.
I'm talking about this gun.
I'm talking about that you need a resistance when you have a republic. And what's
you have the republic
empire?
And the resistance, and you have these, what are they, First Fridays? What are they called?
First Order.
First Order. So the First Order and the Republic and the Rebellion, or they call the Resistance. Resistance of what?
So first off,
yes,
the Empire was defeated with the Emperor. That took away their stranglehold on power.
Okay.
But you can presume that the entire fleet was not at the Death Star. The Rebel fleet is much smaller than the Empire fleet. And so they didn't need to take the entire fleet in order to take on – to overwhelm the Rebels. So there's a whole huge Imperial fleet out there.
Okay. So do you think the Imperial fleet still has a lot of power?
Yes. Absolutely.
So there's just not – it's not called an Empire anymore – Empire anymore because the Emperor was killed. So 18 years ago,
it's not called an empire anymore because they don't have a stranglehold on power anymore.
But
they don't
still
have control
there.
Over the galaxy, but they do have control over their various sectors.
Okay. So you think that basically there's – so why isn't the why are the Rebels and the Republic the same thing? Why is Leia still against the major government? Why isn't Leia part of the major government?
Well, she's not called the Rebels anymore. They're called the Resistance now, right?
Yeah, but –
So you have a government portion, and then you have the armed resistance against the vestiges of the Empire.
Okay.
Because the Empire, like the First Order, are obviously stronger. They're able to build a Starkiller base.
Yeah.
They have these huge resources.
Okay, here's the thing. It's so frustrating. What is up with the whole planets are next to each other and you have a gun that shoots at light speed? Like, what's going on?
Oh, faster than light speed.
The gun shot faster than light speed?
But wait, no. It's faster than light speed to get to the planets, but it's slower than light speed so you can watch the planets get hit.
That's what I'm saying. It's just so ridiculous. I don't understand it at all. It's dumb. Anyway. All right. I got to look up the course.
The beam goes through hyperspace and then comes out of hyperspace just in time to hit the planet.
Starkiller? Do you know why it was named Starkiller?
Because that was Luke's original name, Luke Starkiller.
Damn it.
You serious?
Yeah.
Yeah. In the original drafts for Star Wars, the first movie.
Do you know where the Maz character comes from?
The what?
The Maz character. The wise old lady with the big glasses.
No.
She is based on a school teacher that taught in the LA County School District for like 50 years. And both J.J. Abrams and the production designer had this person as their school teacher. She was a English literature teacher.
So in other words, it pays to be a teacher in certain school districts.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so Hossein Prime is the one that gets destroyed. So the object of the First Order was to eliminate the government that was supporting the New Republic and to test their new weapon, Starkiller. General Hawks. What do you think of General Hawks?
I don't think much of him at all.
Stated his belief that if the Galactic Senate was destroyed, it would be much easier to destroy the New Republic. Hossein Prime was the current capital of the New Republic and the home of the Galactic Senate.
Oh, which was so not Coruscant.
Damn. I thought we were going to be erasing the old planets. All right. All right. Are we done? We're done. Yes? Yeah? Miles has got one more thing he wanted to say. I know it. And Brian wants to get back to work.
Okay, the Finn character, little off to me. He's a sanitation worker. Okay, I can get that.
With really good sword combat training.
He's been sent out on a mission. I mean, so obviously they've had combat training.
Yeah, yeah.
And probably had combat training since the beginning. He just probably wasn't, you know, the higher tier, so he has to put someone on sanitation. Someone has to have KP duty. So,
So the first time he goes on a mission ever.
Right. He completely just loses it and goes, this is wrong. Now, this is someone who has been raised since early childhood
yeah.
and been indoctrinated, and he goes, suddenly this is wrong, and breaks away.
Because he's a good guy.
No, no,
that's the thing, though. He has nothing in his record. They talk about how Phasma says that she he has not done anything before besides this mission that has caused him.
He has nothing in his record, but they have records, meaning that they look for this. That sometimes the training, the indoctrination, doesn't take. So, I mean, that, I thought that made sense. And sure, it wouldn't happen on his second mission. It would happen on his first mission.
What I don't like about it is it makes him this saintly character. He's pure, more pure than you could possibly be, right? Like, he doesn't have anything down against him. He hasn't ever, like, put prisoners away or shot somebody. I mean, granted, it's cool that he's pristine like that, but wouldn't it be more interesting if he was more like Han?
If he was,
And he has immediate loyalty to the pilot that gets him out. He has immediate loyalty to Rey, which is fairly unlike someone who has gone through this trauma. In general, it's someone who is – been put through this very regimented thing. They're very distrustful of outsiders. I mean, this type of thing is very distrustful of outsiders, and it's very hard to make a common bond that would establish loyalty.
Yeah,
I wouldn't say it's immediate loyalty. They do try to establish that his only motivation is to just get away.
He just needs
wherever
a pilot.
Away is, whatever can get him away, that's where he wants to go. But I agree they're not completely successful at that. That would have been even more interesting of character if that is his only goal.
Now, which would have made more sense if he had really fallen for Rey and they were a love interest and they totally thought they copped out with having him kiss him on the forehead.
You thought that was a cop out?
I thought that was a cop out.
Okay. She doesn't have any experience with intimacy of that nature, right? She's been alone since she was 7.
Only parents kiss each other anywhere.
I don't know.
That's all her
experience. I didn't find that problematic. There's obviously tension there to
okay.
play with the next film.
So this is talking Star Wars universe. Mm. So
because if they kiss, they're brother and sister. That's a problem.
Yeah. Luke comes to rescue Leia.
Yeah.
And they kiss just before they go swinging across the chasm.
Yes.
At, you know, some major event going on. He shows up at a planet, like convinces folks, I know how to take on this thing, when he doesn't. To go save her, they tell her, like, he came for you. He was the reason why they came for you. Yeah, I thought that merited something
more.
Yeah,
yeah. And did you? What do you think about Han and Leia not being more affectionate to each other? You're okay with that?
I got that they had been estranged over a long period of time.
Yeah, but they don't even like really. Do they embrace?
They do.
Okay, good.
She nuzzles her head against his chest and he holds
that's
her.
Cool. Yeah, that's cool. All right, wrapping it up. Thanks for listening. Hey, email us if you'd like. But if you do email us, say something about Star Wars spoilers in the email that you send us, because there's other people on the feed that might not have seen this.
Yeah, and for that matter, if you complain about the fact that we did spoilers, I'm sorry. There's no excuse
for
that.
We warned you repeatedly. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, by the way, I was completely successful in avoiding any spoilers before.
Me
the movie.
Too.
Yeah.
Nothing spoiled me. In fact, I didn't even look at the poster enough to really get that Han was that he was in it. So
yeah, I didn't find out that Han died until at least 5 minutes before it happened.
It's pretty obvious.
Oh my!
Well, what's up with these bridges with no banisters? I mean, come on, no. OSHA must hate that project.
I thought it did have.
It had no banisters.
No, it had railings.
No,
it's there
just
was
a flat
there.
Bridge.
Oh, okay.
Of doom. If you walk under that, you're gonna die.
They really don't care about their workers.
No, they don't.
Yeah, it's Star Wars and Lord of the Rings.
What about Akbar being in it? Was that cool?
Yeah, that was fine.
Yeah, oh, that was cool. I like
that. You know, whatever.
Yeah. All right. Emails if you'd like. We're geeks@geekspeak.org. All right. Thanks for listening. Bye.